So I haven't had enough sandwiches and I've had too much wine, so I apologize. I've got two, and the first one is very much an after poem, and then I'm not taking much of the credit for it. I spent a day recently rereading Ilya Kamenskiy's Dancing in Odessa and trying to learn how he does what he does. So this is after his poem, Natalia. Man of deep chest, there are stones inside, swallowed whole, next to a child's song and a child's tractor. You make a well inside of it for me to drink from. Man of long arms, they are branches that can reach over oceans to retrieve histories. Leaves are your fingers, book pages. You let me pluck them before autumn. Man of broad shoulders, you hold graves and grandfathers on them. They pull roads behind you as you run. You make a house for them. You make a house with them for my head. Okay, that's the first one. After, after. This one is an after in okay, slightly tongue-in-cheek. 22 steps to true love. For a man, dance powder-keg dervishes, your friend pulls, hoots, cat calls, consult self-help cabals, forget, sweat, burn brighter. For possession, become surveillant, informant, student of the indispensable skill sets, toilet scrubbing, fellatio, and secret storage. Learn the nod and laugh, recite the offsides rule. For a blessing, employ lipstick voodoo, starve yourself for apparitions of the only hymn, chant rosaries of names of princes and vampires. For a resting place, dream of past lives and present specters, on the strangest of beds, fall into mirrors, the arms of strangers, like the bottoms of lakes and staircases. Minor death in pursuit of your vision. Thanks.
Stuck in there behind the bill together on a street car and we share with time. Thanks, Stephen. Cold call. Your precious time for a moment or two. Your service provider is currently who? Our latest rendition, because of attrition, we're in a position to offer free minutes and modems to you. And channels as clear as a didgeridoo. Tight nylon fishnets, ladders run from the bottom of hay reeks each fall. A toy. He cultivates lawns round the toy, and he is exceedingly shy. A wee drop of milk, alone, she's in silk, he cedes to the flash of a toy. Full street, still at bay, without one reservation, campers roam freely. Dundrum. There was an old man in Dundrum whose dentures were smashed on a plum. Now somewhat remiss, he shies from each kiss while gorging on dry chocolate crumb. But later, that man from Dundrum swapped molars for sticks of chewing gum. From that day to this, he speaks with a hiss through dentures away out of plumb. Moments. Broken white lines pass under the fender, each a split second, a winking cat eye, no time to ponder, past here and now. Pegasus. Parts merge to enchant. Then Zeus, he is gone in one lightning bolt, blow-torched sheet metal. Pre-dawn, I'll return to spot stars on his flanks, hippocrene shod, wings brushing through north. the race, spit on the ocean in the single-handed race, a one-armed yachtsman. The pharmacy. We'll be more careful. We care most for the needy. We dispense with care. Pilgrim soul. I wake slowly, eavesdropping on the faint creak of the outer helm. The wind and the rigging now more plaintive, feeling the pitch more adamant, a quiet gush from the air heater fan, the heel on the same tack more manifest, sensing the steeper roar. In my mind's eye, I see a huge wheel, unmanned, twitching, the masthead light slashing a zigzag arc through the Milky Way like a white star on a yo-yo. I picture the skipper as he cajoles the indifferent face of the chart plotter to reveal a stream of cartographic data from a galaxy of satellites to explode in a myriad of coloured pixels. Then it dawns on me, no engine, no more motor sailing. It was the silence that woke me. I roll further downhill in cosy luxury, my ear an inch from the soporific gurgle as the ocean sluices past our hull. The moon's hidden pull on the tide, adding 3 knots to our speed. 2 more hours of bliss left on watch below before the time to rise again. It's 1:50 a.m. Easter Monday. Thank you.
Our next poet hails from Ottawa, Canada, and operates under the alias Rhythm. So can we have Rhythm?
My real name's Greg, just so you know. But back home, I travel far and wide as a poet, and I do spoken words, so I don't do paper usually. I'm gonna do 2 poems, if that's okay with everybody. A long one and a short one. Again. Is that all right?
Yeah. Sure.
All right. This first poem was written for a poetry competition in Canada. It's called the Poetry Face-Off, which is put on by the CBC every year. And this was written for that. It's called Music Box. Excuse me. There are 3 types of people in the world today. Those in the game, those who watch, and those oblivious to the play. Which one are you? Just wait a second, I want to get this on tape. My Music Box records the paradox of life's true shape. Back in the days when television was a novelty set and radio was still the king and the best way for you to get all of your news and information on the state of the world, we used imaginative methods, mental images swirled. But now today you play a piece of plastic, then plug your ears, pump up the volume while the uber rich exploit your worst fears, and the cable news networks distort with overblown speakers, play foxy games while they maintain the left is making us weaker. Posting photos in our magazines, our young girls see who starve themselves emaciated to be the best they can be. Boys join the army and disarm the brains that ate Uncle Sam. A plan to jam the boy man with fear to topple Saddam and steal the black gold and grab hold of the scepter of power. Except the specter devours, our perspective is soured. Now we expect that these hours and days of self-aggrandizing praise, the lazy onset of ways, for us to fight our malaise. We're lazy intellectually, and we're ruled by the smug, so we deserve our automation. So guess what? Make sure to plug in, just make sure to get a full CD of burnt machines and play it over and over again. It's just as it seems. Yeah, yeah, wait. Hold up a second. To press the pause button and think about this. The reprehensible, invincible principle, thinking now that they could pull the indefensible, suppressing the crowd. And if you think that you could take it, bring it up some decibels. Repress for redress and think it's justifiable to see the mad, maniacal, inspired, and defiant. Keep your finger on the pause and know now that you are compliant. Aiding of that oppression of expression of depression, teaching me lessons and sessions of your evil indiscretions. And when I ask the questions, you're telling me straight to just believe in what I'm hearing and accept without debate. Because I'm a media savvy, intelligent writer of prose. And when I compose, the strength of my script will decompose this terrible hypocrisy smeared across the globe. Pick up my chamois, clean the house, and use my lyrics to probe the inner depths of megalomedia. Engaging in fraud. It plays loud and fast and popular, so they will applaud to condole the music's mass produced by boobs in the booth. It sits in to synthesize, anesthetizing the truth. Fast forward through another day, you're watching the tube frying, your brains at radiation, that machine's a lagoon, unless I like one of the way trains never stop, and I control the other, the speed of momentum, speed of movement, roll. Think about the things that I'm saying. What are the games that we play? Is this world a game of risk, or are we too bored to say? The entertaining litany that assails us daily on the news leaves us with a westernized morality seriously disabused of a desire to help our brothers and our sisters in need. And we must act to counteract with hastiness to do speed. So stop all of the craziness and madness of war, and stop our governments from acting just as before. Mother Nature's being raped, and we're assaulting the creator. Take up the media, it's in your palm, and pop it in the player. CDs, DVDs, cassettes, vinyl, and all MP3s and mini-discs. Whichever way that you ball. Step on the court and bring your music box to spread out the word and see those players nod their heads from the message they heard. The tunes that we are pumping out are produced by demand. Remand the vicious with the contraband and fist up your hand to smash the vessels that empower those who hold undue sway over the people's information that they seek every day. Victory will come to those that make the second last mistake. So play the music of love with volume. So foundations will shake. There are three types of people in the world today. Those in the game, those who watch, and those oblivious to the play. Which one are you? Just wait a second, I want to get this on tape. My music box rocks the orthodox to take a new shape. Wax and wane, when life leaves you taxed with visceral pain. Light up the flame that patterns the airless facts with a wish for the gin when the wick reacts. All the chemicals above eat oxygen for lunch, then breathe heat red and yellow with incendiary punch. Then dribble wax down your sides. If you prize the rise of smoke signals before your eyes, think of peaceful ways to force the pain of flame to wane. So stick your candle in the wax, chanting this refrain. Stick your candle in the wax, chanting this refrain. Light your wick with permanence to fight off the rain. Live your life with perseverance, torching all who gain from those living their lives taxed with visceral pain. This is my candle in the wax, and I'll say it again. This is my candle in the wax, stuck outside the main. Thank you.
And I reckon the best way to follow that is with a very sharp poem, but it's not like the others. From a friend of mine, Owen, I texted him during the week on how's it going, he sent me back this. I wait for dull day, like a tiger stalking its prey. There will be pints, there will be cigarettes, and I will be king for a day.
We have John Salkins. John.
I'm a Yorkshireman from the far north of Scotland, so it's a bit of a this first poem is about how you can live simultaneously in several worlds, if you like, and it's called Semi-Permeable Membrane. Those of you can remember doing this in chemistry or whatever, where the things can sometimes go through and sometimes can't. So many ways of reaching the other side. A photograph, a dream maybe, or some cathartic experience in the theatre. The art of the muses, or meditation. Phatic communion to the ultimate extreme. Boring the disengaged mind literally to death. Tradition and culture, religion and sex, an out-of-body experience on the operating table. All of these show just how easy it is to dip in and out of another place and time. call the shit sandwich. You have a nice one and then a nasty one and a nice one. So I'll do the nasty one in the middle. This one's about the voices you hear if you're schizophrenic. It's called Inner Conflict. Positive auditory hallucinations. Hypercritical demons undermining you with their scorn. But where do you hear them? Are they internal or external voices? Can they be objectively evidenced? Usually they are silent, but occasionally you will detect them as you observe their host's lips mouthing their words. As the message becomes more vivid, the medium will sub-vocalize their utterances, appearing to chunter away to himself. In rare instances, the hearer of voices will take on the identity of his impersonae as if possessed by the devil. And the last one, this one's called Rare Frequencies. I thought I'd come up with a novel title, but I found out that the band REM had already claimed that one, so I kept it for the title of my poems, the collection of poems. So this is called Rare Frequencies. Oscillating subliminally, these visible sounds create cosmic interference. Supersonic, vibraphonic, pulsating matter resides above, beyond, and beneath, tangentially aligned. There can be no linear convergence. Observe the centrifugal ripples, dancing circles of light on water that bends it back to whence it came. Thank you.
Hello, I'm still in morbid mood. This is a page from a short story. It's a ghost story and it's set in the Irish famine. And there's three children in this little valley, but alas, everyone else is dead and the dogs are starving. And they surrounded the house, and it's night time. An hour passes. The dogs have not tried to get in the door again, but they have not left either. There is nowhere for them to go. Every so often, when the pangs of hunger are too much, they get up and prowl around, watching the smoke and sparks rising from the chimney. Long into the night, the three children huddle around the fire, praying the turf will last, knowing it cannot. They watch as the flames lower and disappear. Desperately, Deirdre takes the poker and rakes the embers for every last bit of heat and light. She rakes until the red glow turns to orange, then yellow, until there is nothing but sparks that one by one blink out in the grey ashes. When they're all gone, Ellie lights the stub of the candle. It is the last candle but one. The other one, our holy one, is in the little bedroom where their grandmother died. The minutes pass slowly into an hour, 2 hours, the candle dies. The cottage is now in the grip of that strange cold dark that only happens in the dead of night. Everything is held in a kind of spell. There's nothing to give comfort, nothing earthly. The sun may never rise again. The dead hours glide slowly by, hearse-like, drawn by the black horses of night. The children walk desperately and hopefully after the horses, clinging to their halters, hoping to be drawn away from the nightmare and into sleep. 3 o'clock, 3:30, 4 o'clock. Children are curled up close by the dead hearth, unable to sleep. They clutch their worn blankets beneath their chins in an effort to keep out the cold. The bow-shaped moon drifts between the clouds, sending shafts of pale light down over the fields. Several of the smaller dogs, noticing there is no more smoke from the chimney, rise and prowl about, baring their teeth at each other, as if practicing. A grey wolfhound slips through the open gate, goes right up to the cottage door and gives it an exploratory push. It leans its paws up on the window ledge, then flattens them against the window pane and locks in. The curtain blocks the dark interior from view, and all he sees in the moonlight is the reflection of his own wild, starving face. One of the smaller dogs leaps up onto the cart, and from there springs onto the roof of the cottage, where a moment later two more join him. Deirdre, awakened by the startling cawing of the crows and the sudden flurry of their wings as they scatter from the roof of the neighbouring cottage, sits bolt upright and wakes the others. Together they hear the scrunch of paws on the thatch and down the chimney, the sound of rhythmic panting. The minutes drag on agonisingly as the dogs move about on the thatch. Ellie opens her eyes and stares into the dark. Surely dawn cannot be far away now. Surely the dogs cannot get down the chimney. If only they can hold out till dawn. With morning, the dogs may go away. There might be a faint glimmer of hope again for them. A new day, they will leave the valley. They will find food somewhere. If only the dogs can be kept out. But it is not to be.
Do you have Jackie in
Jackie. Hi there. I just want to say that we're here for a big international conference on mental health that's taking place in Killarney on Wednesday. So I have these two poems in my little collection. I didn't expect to be here tonight, but I thought I'd read them anyway. So the first one's called I'm Normal Now. By the way, I've used poetry a lot for just expressing emotions and getting through experience. It's a great way to do that, I found. Not, I'm not a poet in any way, but it's a good way to express. I'm normal now, sighs of relief from family and friends. The days are steady. I can paint and manage all the tasks. Flowers are blooming in the garden, slightly dull without their manic glow. I've checked my emails and updated Facebook, watched EastEnders on the telly while doing the ironing really fast. I've lost my two companions, M and D, although they'll always be a part of me. I'm totally polarised and balanced. I'm not depressed, I'm not elated, not even a little bit excitable. I'm walking the line, I'm one of the many. Don't stand out in the crowd. Everyone's proud. They think I'm normal now. And the other one is the other one is called the heirloom. Who could imagine, beautiful baby, the heirloom of affliction concealed within the blemished gene? Absolute innocence, smile oblivious, eyes clear, no fear. The christening gown passed down with pride the generations. The curse well hidden, starched out by hands that sense foreboding. No sign, no hint throughout your childhood days as you danced your journey from babe to girl. Only with your blossoming did it steal your mind, twisting your ripening, full bloom to blight.
Good afternoon, folks. I'm going to read two poems. The first one is a short 10-line poem called Tetractus, and the Tetractus is basically the first four positive integers in the number sequence, numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4, and that's what this poem is about. Tetractus. Pythagoras, they say, was a prisoner in Babylon. sailed home to teach and build bridges in Crotona, climbed a mountain to escape the base materialism of the Erin Sybarites. Finally, he discovered a box, and opening it for all to see, freed himself before slinking home for a deep and peaceful slumber. That's it. And the second poem is about a winter I spent living in Spain, and it's called Slow Days. Slow Days. I remember the one you told with a paramedic's nonchalance, about 7 hangings and 6 shifts. You almost laughed. Remarkable, those elocution lessons, the ones that pop their heads in the door of every conversation, how they failed you sometimes. Still, it inspired me to notice things. Skeletons of trees, quiet mornings, the odd flurry of sleet, as if it meant something to hear you speak of a marked umbra on the Cambridge calendar, days when the patter of rain was perfected by the steam and whistle of the teapot.
In Dunqueen some years ago, so maybe she was coming to tell me that one day I would be wise. This is called Facing a Hare. Once, at a cliff's edge, I was within a hair's breadth of a hare. Holding my breath, I stood rooted for what seemed an eternity, then remembered the camera slung about my neck. She read my thoughts, was gone before I could move a muscle, my reactions slow and muddy in the face of her sprung swiftness. That face still haunts me, neither bold nor fearful, simply there, as open and wild as the universe at its birth, a word in her stare.
Definitely need more hikes of your caliber. Live really in Okai.
This is a sort of a love poem. Morning speeds upon perfection. All the years of falling down bright life, bumping off rough sides that slowed the slide, left faint marks to prove the fissured fact and validate the age that she defied in every other facet of her being. The sun that turned the faultless skin to gold and smoothed the tiny marks of mass and mind, now in the satin light of dawn, steals back again, a shy intruder on the scene, made bold by riches stored beneath the night. A calf and thigh escape the dark, provoking thoughts of action fit for long gone untamed youth. Those 20 years unblemished, then the fall through 40-fold of tumbling to perfection. The same object of this little bit of one. Singing of your soul, Of what is past or passing or to come, I do not know. For I have not attended to your story until now. Your suffering inscribes a message that reminds whatever is begotten lives and dies. I should imprint your spirit on a page to be unfolded, read, and realized by our descendants, to make them proud of my obsession, my Byzantium.
I'll just say two poems, one short and one reasonably short. The first poem is called Orphan. Love, given too early to remember in words, before the spell of toast or a shaving foam kiss, it's there when I wake in the night. And the second poem is called Salvage, subtitled Winchester Cathedral. Remember the war dead, names in black ink, curlicues, in the locked glass case, by the open book, an immaculate note, to whom, please turn these pages with an ivory knife. There were soldiers too, who rode the aisles, Puritans sweeping down statues, upturning ossuaries, flinging bones of Saxon kings into stained light. Look at it now, the great window remade, from glass underfoot, all at random, supplicating hands, a vacant halo, half a face, as if all the king's horses put it together again. Thank you.
She's very comfortable over there, but Mary is going to have to stand up and do this one. Mary, do you?
I got stuck in Lisbon recently with the ash cloud, so I tried to make good use of my time by eating lots of salt cod and listening to the strange singing that they do there. The Fado House of Argentina Santos. The women here are of a certain age. Their doubles hang in black and white on the walls. Photos showing the wailing women of 1930s Lisbon. Hair set in birds' nests. Eyebrows penciled. The ancient Doyenne, queen of the Fadistas, sits in her lair by the door, a hawk in navy blue. A serving hatch cut into the azulejo tiled walls frames her elder sister, faithful retainer in black and broderie anglaise. Her task is to fix lace doilies into bread baskets and spy. Not a word passes between her and the others, middle-aged meninas spilling out of their worn needlepoint bibs, pinned by tight bows at the waist. Nightly they dance their angry fandango on fallen arches and varicose veins, battling in the time between fados to get the tubs of bacalao down to the trestles where the drunken tourists wait. On the half hour, lights are flicked off. A silver-haired fadista steps from the shadows, cradling herself in a fringed shawl. She opens her throat and ululates in broken tremolo for the old dreams, for Lisboa, for what was lost, and her frilled serving sisters stomp the dough-white flesh of their calves and scowl, and Argentina Santos watches from the door. Thank you.
Assuming that flicker of light was that call. Next we have Matthew Sweeney.
The Blue Hammock. Behind the tool shed, among the nettles and rusting horseshoes, I buried the key. The white dog watched me, whimpering, as if he disapproved of what I was doing. But when I unearthed a bone and threw it, he bounded away, barking into the field. I replaced the spade in the shed, strode off to the blue hammock, and climbed into it. Swaying from side to side, I began to hum the tune from the first spaghetti western, where Clint raises his poncho and shoots, then lights up another cigarillo. Above me, the silver birch with my initials stretched upward to its far-off father, the moon. They would never, ever find that key. And in the morning, I would head for Lisbon, where I'd rent a room in hilly Alfama, then translate the entire work of Brecht. The seagulls are huge there, and musical. The crows spend most time on the ground. And this poem is for that stone horse, who has to smell all that wine every single night. And I spent some time, about 2 years ago, in a writer's colony in Switzerland, in a little village, in a chateau. And it was about 10 or maybe 5 kilometers from Lake Geneva. And there was a vintner making really good wine in the village, and there were really serious looking racehorses. Ballad of the Horse and Wine. A horse neighed a loud hello as I went by with wine. He did it to let me know he wanted what was mine. I ignored him and walked on with my sad half case. His neighs followed me down to a dim castle-y place. I was holed up there with others, a rag-taggled bunch of daughters, fathers, mothers, all now eating lunch. I carried my clinking stash in, and one fellow got up to snatch a bottle of the wine. Another grabbed a cup. He filled this to the very brim. Before the rest could start, I retreated to my room to calm my beating heart. Then I saw the horse's head through the window glass and heard how he neighed and refused to pass. So I hurried out to him to feed him some wine, whacking him on the bum as he glugged it down. I retrieved the other bottles and felt like Lord Byron as the horse and I tottered to the Chateau de Chillon. We finished them all there, then both fell asleep by Lake Geneva's waters, 1,000 feet deep.
Connor McMahon, so that goes to maybe the star of the short story. Connor.
this is the start of a larger piece. It's also the introduction to a day in what urbanites might call a sleepy village where nothing happens. Morning prayers. John Daly finished his ablutions and came down the stairs and looked out the door and stepped out onto the dry street in his socked feet to see if anyone or anything was moving. He crossed the dry concrete to the brown cut stone wall to a place beside the copper beech tree. and leaned on his thumbs and knuckles and looked onto Low Street. The hollow sound of the convent bell greeted him. It was 10 to 8. He looked straight ahead to the bank, no light on yet. He looked to the right down to Jimmy's shop, and to the left up to the barrack door. The barrack door is open. He sees Mr. and Mrs. Steady, slicked and curled, come walking on the footpath around the Carrickgold corner, past Healy's closed shop door, and pass along in the shadow of the bank, heading up to Mass in the convent. Joe Healy, shopkeeper, exits his hall door and follows them not far behind. Morning, morning, beautiful morning that. A powerful day, thanks be to God. He hears cars from the Balmaglera direction change down hard as they come into the tight corner at the Red Bank, and change up and accelerate as they come up Low Street, and change down and brake hard to take the turn for Carrick on two wheels, on their way to work in the council, or the P&T, or the ESV. Have to be there for 8, early start. You'd swear it was Mandela. A girl stands on the corner waiting for a lift, rain or shine, but never has to wait too long. The tink, tink, clink of jam jars as a forklift hits a rut, and its cargo wobbles carries across the derelict roofs of the market yard, and into the crevices of the town. And on the sloping ground behind the roofs, John sees a blue coat with a white paper hat walking across the sloping yard. Nolan, the floor manager, on the move already, loading up for Chum or Dubai. The Arabs like their jam. The baker's widow and her hanging mantella passes on her way up to convent mass. Morning now. Royal blue uniformed schoolgirls and a woman with a plastic bag stand under the canopy of Croft's shop entrance, waiting for the bus. A man gets out of one car on Low Street and jumps into another and heads in the Carrick direction. The long fiberglass area bends like a roach pole with a perch, almost touching the road as the driver accelerates away. Two toots and a horn, nod of the head, a full arm's length wave. A white van pulls to a halt in front of Jimmy's and throws out newspapers and speeds off. Black flags adorn the telephone poles. Tim Donahue pushes his cart on Low Street, sweeping. Swift swoop from the eaves of the thatched roof. A woolly wagtail hops from the wall to the street and back to the wall again. Crows rising and settling on Jimmy's chimney pots. One shot would get the two of them. The barrack door is open. Seems a bit airy. Guard Ryan and the sergeant, the two of them, out at this hour, on a Tuesday morning. Father Degnan, late for Mass, stops and knocks at the hall door of the corner house to buy the Independent from a Republican publican, so he can read why the nuns serve up a soft-boiled egg, pinch of salt, butter, and their best china after a quick Mass, for Jimmy of the shop is not yet out of bed. And the master, an old Republican with one eye, God knows why, some misadventure in his youth, or maybe active service, marches briskly down Low Street, suit trousers creased and turned up, black shoes shining, his felt fedora shading his eyes, and his specially made black-rimmed glasses with one clear pane and one frosted pane that hides his bad eye, aimed by the press of an old comrade. How are you this morning, master? Morning, John. Jimmy's wife nudges him out, and he brings in the newspapers, and cuts their strings on top of the ice cream fridge, and looks at page 3 before the first farmer comes in for a large bottle of red lemonade that will be used to quench a thirst before noon in the dry meadow somewhere, or at a reek the size of a house, or a pipe behind a byre, or in a hay barn, where he's forking hay to the roof of the buckrick to young lads tramping it down and resting. Across the square from Jimmy's, Hop Gilrain the butcher dreams of his red TR7 with its pop-up headlamps, while Sergeant Doyle bangs on his door until he eventually gets out, and Doyle and Ryan drag a shop dog through the shop and put him into Hock's freezer for safekeeping. John Daly turns to go back into a plate of rasher and boxy. Matins over. Thank you.
We're nearly done, but we couldn't finish without something from that.
Just a short story this time, called The Postmodernist. I don't think I've ever read this one here before, so it'll be new to me as well, probably. The Postmodernist. He lived in the most cosmopolitan country in the world and ate in the most ritzy Chinese restaurants whenever he liked. It wasn't that he was averse to Indian food, but he usually wasn't hot on it, as it didn't agree with his stomach, or with other parts of him somewhat lower down. He wore Gucci shoes quite simply because he had the money to buy them. He fancied Versace designed clothes, although it is unlikely that Versace fancied him anymore. He had paintings by Picasso and Constable and Rinaldi adorning his walls, but they weren't originals, of course. He recalled having been in love with a mountainous woman from Tibet and yet another from Easter Island who was particularly upright and strong. He abandoned his native religion and spent a while as an atheist before converting to the Mormons because he liked their manners. He thought later that Buddhism had possibilities because it was modish among musicians and film stars. He travelled through Patagonia because he had read the book, and he wished to walk on the Great Wall of China because he heard it could be recognised from the moon. He had books of poetry by Nikolai Lilyev, the Bulgarian one, and by Vincenzo Monti, even though he couldn't persuade everybody else of his brilliance. He admired Vladimir Solokin's experiments in free verse and was turned on by the force of Alfred Lichtenstein's work. This is a great name dropping, isn't it? As regards music, he had a Catholic taste. His ears delighted in Moussa Poussi and Ronnie Frug and the Cajun Kings, not to mention Papa Wemba and Kostadin Verminov and Mahmoud Tabrizi Zadeh and Marta Sebastian in particular, although he did have to admit that he drew the line at Daniel O'Donnell. He could gobble potatoes from Cyprus or drive a Japanese car. He remembered some French from school and learned some tourist Spanish, and he knew some German from those war films. He had a book of Latin because he was going to Latin America, and some Finnish for use in the sauna, and very fluent English, which had thousands of foreign words through it. When he died, however, he was buried in a coffin of dark Irish oak, as was only proper.